everybody, and welcome to episode 65 of the Auto Movie Podcast. On this day in 1979, Voyager 1, the probe, reached Jupiter. And with all of the advanced equipment it had on board, it still cannot locate my interest in Talladega Nights.
Oh, I was going to make some joke about it being as far away from us as Max Verstappen is from the rest of the F1.
That would be good. I'm still not entirely sure what Christopher Nolan sees in Talladega Nights, but that's another podcast for another day.
Or a podcast we've already recorded, frankly. I'm sure you reviewed Indeed. Talladega Nights, and I still haven't watched it, because I'm not great with Will Ferrell at the best of times, and I'm just not sure I can take that much distill, like, concentrated Will Ferrell.
That is Marty Spain. I'm, as ever, Chris Ratcliffe. And this is the podcast where we talk about all things cars and movies and YouTube and all that sort of thing. If there's a car moving in it, we'll basically probably talk about it. And to start off this week's episode, we have... I've lost my notes. What's the first thing that we're talking about?
We're talking about Lionheart, which is...
Never knowingly prepared.
The documentary about Dan Weldon, a former... IndyCar racer, race winner, double, I think, Indy 500 winner, who very sadly passed away in a horrible, unnecessary accident, I want to say 11 years ago now.
It was something like that, yeah.
It's a long time ago. And I remember being absolutely gutted because I was sort of following IndyCar, but not quite. And I heard about it and thought, oh no, another one. But this was when IndyCar still seemed dangerous. And I remember looking for the clip. I probably slightly ghoulishly looked for it on YouTube, but the bit I saw was the tribute lap that they all did afterwards. There's a very long stoppage. I remember seeing the guy from IndyCar come out in the press conference and announce that Dan had passed away. And I remember thinking, man, you've got some guts to do that. That is probably the worst thing you'll ever have to do, the worst job you will ever have. And then I remember seeing Dario Franchitti's face, because he was very close with Dan Weldon. I remember just seeing, like, if you could draw a picture of just shock and grief, that was it. It was absolutely horrible. But the joy of it was everybody then remembering all their favourite Dan Weldon stories, coming out with the... You know, when he started in IndyCar and he got his teeth fixed. So he had this massive, blinding white smile in all the pictures. Particularly look at his Indy 500 sort of victory lane photos with the milk and and everything. And he's just got this massive all-American smile. He was going places, and it's such a shame that he passed before his time. And he had two young boys. And this documentary kind of covers Dan's life and career, but he's also now starting to cover his two boys, one of whom is basically on the road to Indy. He's following in Dad's footsteps, and I imagine that puts their mother in a tricky spot, without wishing to dig into it too much. I'm sure the documentary covers all this. It's going to be on probably Sky Atlantic. It's screening on HBO Max in the States on the 12th of March. And I hope that we get to see it on Sky reasonably soon, because I am really interested in this one. I think it's going to be a tough watch because, you know, Dan Weldon himself is going to loom large over the whole thing. But I am looking forward to seeing how they deal with everything, and hoping that he gets a celebration of his due, because he was kind of an unsung star, really. And they named the IndyCar that he'd been developing, because I think he was out of a drive, and he'd been doing testing for what became the DW12, the Dallara standard chassis for the following year. And he got, I think basically he got a drive with some prize money, and, you know, sort of on the off chance. Basically he was racing for his career, but he'd got something in the bag, he'd signed something, and he was going to go forward in 2012. He was going to be in a good seat, but he wanted to fulfill the obligation he had to race, and sadly wasn't able to complete the race and passed away. And I want to see it because I want to see him celebrated. I was thinking about this. I was listening to the Bring Back V10s podcast from the Race Media, and they had a great question. And I'll put this to you now, and you can have a think about it and then come back to me at the end of the show. If you could change one thing about the V10 era of Formula One, what would it be? You can do anything. Like, someone doesn't go to a team. Somebody doesn't win a race. The obvious things. So we're talking about sort of racing decisions, not necessarily I would like to see, Imola 94, Ayrton Senna does not crash, doesn't die. Things like that are almost those are a given. It's more interesting things like one of the show presenters said they'd like to have seen Justin Wilson stay in F1. Because thinking of Dan Weldon makes me think of Justin Wilson, who also similarly and very tragically lost his life at an IndyCar race and was also similarly really underappreciated for what he did. Was an absolutely brilliant racing driver who had an unconventional career in Formula One, and then when that petered out, went over and had some success over in the States. And they said, what if Jaguar had hung on to Justin Wilson, and where could his career have gone then? And I thought, that's a fantastic answer to, like, what would you change? And I thought, I was thinking, like, I would change, like, you think, Raikkonen in 2005, I'd want all the Mercedes Ilmor engines to be reliable. And then that title is Raikkonen's. Somebody said, I'd change going to groove tyres. That was a terrible idea. I was like, yeah, that's a good one. And then you go, oh, no, wait a minute. I would change. There's so many of these things. You go, just change one thing and see what happens. It's a great question. It's got nothing to do with movies, TVs, or anything like this. Promoting somebody else's podcast. But if you don't listen to the Race Media Bring Back V10s podcast, you really, really should. It is absolutely epic if you grew up with V10 engines on your television on a Sunday afternoon. So, do check that out. Have a think about what you would change. I think for me, it's definitely going to be having those Mercedes Ilmor engines not blow up all the time in 2005, and then Kimi Raikkonen would have a championship at his peak with McLaren, which would be wonderful. It means that then Fernando Alonso doesn't win the 2005 title. Does he win the 2006 title? Where does he go? Does he go to McLaren? Does Raikkonen stay at McLaren? It just opens up all these wonderful possibilities of what could have been. Anyway, sorry. Lionheart documentary. We want to see it.
I would say, just thinking quickly off the top of my head, the two things that spring to mind, one I think without groove tyres, that would have been interesting. But more than that, if there had been testing restrictions during that early 2000s period, because that was the time when Ferrari had a test team and a tyre test team, and Michael was...
And their own circuit. Let's not forget their own circuit. Their huge, the most built-in advantage that, as a Formula One fan during that time, used to rile me up more than anything else, was the fact that they had their own circuit that they could run at 24/7, and they did. Is it any wonder that they won all the time?
The one thing, and I don't know if this would fit into the V10 era, or it might be a touch too late... If Kubica hadn't had his rallying crash...
That's 2000... That's V8s. You're right. It's quite a way into the V8s too, but you're right. That's a wonderful what-if question. But yes, there's so many of them. But I thought confining it to the V10 era was quite an interesting exercise, because you can have what if Senna didn't go to McLaren in... 1988, and then that's not quite V10, that's Turbo V6, but they were all V10s, or all naturally aspirated with V10s in 89. So what if Senna wasn't in McLaren in 89? That would be an interesting one. Who goes there instead of him? Where does Senna go?
There was an interesting one put forward by Eddie Jordan, which was, what would have happened if Heinz Harald Frentzen hadn't been bumped for Takuma Sato?
I would much rather the one, what if Heinz Harald Frentzen had just fucked right off and Damon Hill would have kept his seat for 97?
That's where I was going.
You know me too well, but that would be a completely different thing. But yes, fascinating. We've just spent, I don't know, 10 minutes promoting somebody else's podcast. But yes, Dan Weldon documentary. Look out for it on Sky Atlantic if you are interested in British racing drivers, particularly sort of largely unheralded British racing drivers, and have a, if you've got a bit of an interest in IndyCar, I'm hoping that this is a good story that's not too mawkish and it's not too maudlin, and that it does justice to Dan but doesn't make it all awkward. I don't think I can sit through like an hour and a half of his wife being all you know.
No,
but we'll see.
Watching the trailer, I think it's a really interesting idea to have part of it being a celebration of him and his life, but then having this through line where there's the continuation. So it's what's happened with his kids, what happens with their the family business, for a slightly twee way of putting it. But we've had things like, we had the Schumacher documentary where you got Ralph, who was talking, and he was talking about what it was like to be a racing driver and what it's like to be a Schumacher, but his dad was never there. And that was kind of the really fascinating bit of that documentary. But I suspect Dan's kids are probably a bit too young to kind of ask that question of...
They were very young when he passed. Like? And it was such the tragedy. I think it was...
Yeah.
It was just before I had children. And I was sort of hypersensitive to all that kind of thing in the way that you are. If you have young children, you're about to have children, you become very sensitive to those kinds of things. And so it hit close to home for me, certainly. But we'll look forward to seeing that, and we'll report definitely back once we've found a way of watching it. Let's see. Well, I want to do a bit of follow-up. Friend of the show, Chris Frew, texted me a couple of days ago to say he was flying to Vegas, and on the plane, what should he watch? Should he watch Gran Turismo or Ferrari or both? And I said, start with Gran Turismo and then watch Ferrari. And tell me if you laugh when Kenny gets killed. I mean, Marino. I mean, Castellotti. And in the end, I think he watched Gran Turismo and said it was entertaining and dumb. He was interested to know how much of it was real. Like, how much of it really happened. And I think I said something along the lines of, well, he was called Jan Mardenborough, and yes, there was an accident at the Nürburgring, and everything else is nonsense. And I said this confidently, having not watched the movie.
I think
I still haven't watched it.
I don't blame you. I think it is, as we said in the last podcast, it is based on real events, and there are things in it that are out of sequence, there are things in it that are... the real events become the backdrop to the emotional story that they're trying to tell. But a surprising amount of it is genuinely real. It's things that happen.
Well, Chris watching it and kind of going back saying, yeah, I enjoyed that, it's kind of made me go, right, I've got to go back. I've got to get beyond all the Nissan logos and the mentions of Nissan, and I can't take a drink every time someone says Nissan or I will pass out and my liver will explode. But I am going to now... Like, I'm going to give it a shot. I'm going to try and power through and come back and report on how I found it. What else? After watching Ferrari, which we talked about in the last show, I actually found myself going back to rewatch a documentary we covered in a previous podcast. I can't remember which one, but there was a documentary called Ferrari. What the hell is it called?
It wasn't Race to Survive.
No.
Race to Glory.
Race to Immortality, I think.
That was it. Was that one that's full of statistics?
No. Not really, no. So this is the one that covers basically a decade of Ferrari and the many drivers that drove for him and those that passed away. And having seen Michael Mann's sort of recreation of a lot of these races and a lot of the cars, and I wanted to go back and see the real thing, and I'd forgotten that this documentary is basically a love letter to all the talented Brits that drove for Ferrari and who drove during that era. And there's so much amazing vintage footage in there. The archive stuff they've got in there is beautiful, and I really enjoyed it. I bought it on Blu-ray, I watched it on the TV instead of just like in a little window in a browser, and I really enjoyed going back and just, there's not much of actual Enzo in there, it's just all on the drivers and with a little bit on the cars. And I can't remember what I said at the time. I think I was probably a bit shocked at how callous the reaction seemed to be from this just litany of drivers who died. But actually going and rewatching it, having watched the film and sort of being in that mindset, I just enjoyed seeing that era of Driver and appreciating the cars for what they were, appreciating the just the crazy danger of all the circuits. And I'd recommend, if you've seen Ferrari and you enjoyed it and you were engaged by the racing scenes in particular, go and hunt this documentary down. I bought it on Blu-ray from Amazon, I think, for not very much, like less than a tenner. And okay. It's worth having for the footage alone. It's absolutely incredible. And it sounds really good too. So I went back and revisited that and thoroughly enjoyed it. And I recommend that you do too.
Excellent. Yeah, that sounds like a good watch. I'll definitely track a copy down, because I think, I'm not sure I've watched it after you mentioned it. What I have watched since our last episode, how's that for a segue, is the now sixth season of Drive to Survive on Netflix, the famous, very famous now documentary series.
Do you remember when the first one came out? Do you remember how...
Oh, yes.
Like how refreshing it was and how amazing it was to see how they'd portrayed the sport that we loved, and how, you know, there was no input from Ferrari or Mercedes. It was all of the smaller characters. It was all the stories you don't see being told. And we were so excited about it. And no one knew what it was, but I knew, you and I knew, that there was this new documentary coming out called Drive to Survive on Formula One. It had been commissioned by F1, it's going on Netflix, and it was going to be amazing. And now I find myself almost dreading it.
So, funny you should mention that, because I was thinking about this before we started recording, because I remember those first couple of series that were surprising. I mean, the first series was a bolt out of the blue. Even
surprising is the right word. It was so different to anything that had been done before, except maybe in the States. Maybe there's some,
yes,
you know, NBA or NFL documentaries that have this kind of flavour. But for for European sports, for motorsport, this was so different.
It really was. But then once the surprise had gone, and once the spontaneity of it had gone, it then became, I talked about it at the time, being like a Faustian pact between the teams and Netflix trying to get themselves coverage. And it went from being this kind of shocking behind the scenes look to trying to tell the story of Formula One. It caught, purely by coincidence, 2021, which will, I think, go down as one of the great races, one of the great seasons, sorry, of,
it's the season,
of
it's,
F1 history.
It's caused a huge problem, both for Drive to Survive, but also for Formula One itself, because between the two of them, between that season and then Drive to Survive, boosting interest and the tribalism of that, you know, Rebel versus Mercedes, Max versus Lewis, and then the denouement in Abu Dhabi, whatever way you think of the result that happened, it cannot be changed. And so they've been chasing that high ever since, and they can't get near it because of, you know, circumstance and rule sets and budget caps and so on. The Formula One is struggling, and I imagine that Drive to Survive is going to... I don't know. I like, how many more series of this are we going to get?
Well, so this is the thing. I think last year I said that it really wasn't worth a watch. Just watch the clips, follow the memes. That's basically all you need. Somebody has clearly taken this on board, and this series is actually a really nice companion piece to the series. It's not the great behind-the-scenes look, but it's also not rehashing the thing that we watched last year. The first episode is... Well, in fact, most of the episodes, to some degree or another, are telling stories which you either didn't hear or giving space to people that you don't normally hear from. So the first episode is focuses on Aston Martin, Lance Stroll breaking his hand, Lawrence Stroll comes across really sympathetically. And
that's not what I hear. All the podcasts I hear just talk about how he's really menacing and has a large head.
Well, both of those things are true. But when he talks about... Because the thing is with Formula One is that we only tend to hear from the people during Grand Prix weekends or at car launches. So, Lawrence, how's your car going to do? How's that thing? But then when you hear him say he got a phone call saying that his son had been in a, you know, in a mountain bike accident on the other side of the world, and he wasn't thinking as a team boss. He was thinking as a father and his son. When you hear Lance talking about how he's driving through the pain simply because he looks and he thinks, I can't let my father down.
I think that's a big part of Lance's just whole approach to F1. I have to admit,
yeah,
he earned an awful lot of goodwill at the start of last season, doing what he did, turning up in obvious pain, pushing through it, and doing great performances in what was second best car at that point. The problem is that as soon as his hand got better, the car got worse, and so he sort of drifted back down the grid into normal Lance Stroll semi-invisible territory.
Yeah. But there does seem to be more stories being told on Drive to Survive this year, and more behind the scenes, away from the circuit type footage. So,
which is the stuff you can't get, stuff what you don't see on Sky unless they've done a little feature or something. That it, I toyed with going back to watch it, so I didn't watch last season at all. The sort of the come down from 2021 and how I felt about that season, and then 2022 not being a particularly engaging season, and then similarly with this, 2023 as a Formula One season had its moments but was largely on track very dull. And so I was thinking, well, how on earth is the, I keep up with the news. Am I going to be engaged in any of this off-track stuff? I'm not going to watch anything that has Red Bull to the fore because I've no desire to watch them be smug about how good they are. And Max is just not an engaging televisual figure. He's not. He doesn't want to be. That's fine. But I feel like I enjoyed it way more than when he didn't. When he just wasn't in it. Because he doesn't have anything interesting to say. Rather, that's not fair. He doesn't put forward anything interesting in television interviews. He doesn't want to engage in that. He's a lot like Kimmy in that sense. Mm. I get the feeling that he is going to be the kind of person that's going to, every 3 or 4 years, some interviewer is going to catch him in the right mood and ask the right questions and get a really great interview. But I don't think that's going to be on Drive to Survive. Whereas you've got your sort of eternal stars. I presume Danny Rick has a great storyline because he did have a great storyline last year. Yep. But I can imagine maybe, I'm hoping that Liam Lawson is on there. I can imagine Alex Albon having a great storyline on there. Maybe, I don't know, Oscar Piastri is just like a cipher. I have no idea what's going on behind that guy's eyes. But I'd love for his manager, Mark Webber, himself an ex-Formula One driver, and I'd love for him to be on there. I'm not sure I need to see Will Buxton explaining what a pit stop is for the seventh time. Or, you know, what's that like? Is it still playing to the newbies, or is this now established enough that they're not holding your hand, they're not babying you anymore?
So I would say that it's definitely not as not as basic as it has been in years gone by. But I think also that they're aware that the audience is becoming more F1 literate, and you still get the Alex, I think it's Alex Jax is doing the exposition commentary.
He's Basil exposition. I think he's done that before a lot. He's a great commentator. Yeah. I really enjoy his work.
But I will say, actually, speaking of people who are on it, I saw people on Twitter complain that Danica Patrick was appearing on it. And I think that's just angry white men getting angry.
There's a lot of Danica hate on...
Yeah, for no reason.
I understand. I mean, she's a reasonable on-camera presence. I don't... When I've seen her presenting with Sky, she doesn't have a great deal of insight because she's not a Formula One driver, and she wasn't a Formula One driver. She was a racing driver, and she had some success. But she can only speak to the sort of general, and yeah. and she's a decade out of it now, I think, more or less.
Pretty much.
She can't just, speak to the specifics of F1, so she's kind of there to be a sort of a pundit and also a presenter.
What they do have, which I think was a masterstroke and didn't get nearly enough coverage for me, Claire Williams has been brought in as a pundit, as a talking head, which I think is a great choice because I think she's really good.
Presumably she has enough distance from the sport after, what, 2 years away, 3 years away? When did they sell up?
More than that, I think.
So she's been away for a while, so she can come back more or less like an outsider looking in and maybe have an interesting perspective there. I liked Claire Williams. I don't know how much of Williams's troubles were down to her leadership and how much was down to the culture there that was so ingrained from the Frank and Patrick days. I always felt like she wasn't given her due in keeping it going. And she seemed like a nice person. I don't know, but I'm sort of tempted to go back and watch this series, but almost like on fast forward. I don't know if you do that thing with podcasts. I do this with lots of podcasts where I play it at 1.5 times speed.
Yeah.
So loads of podcast players have the 1.5 times speed. So I don't know how podcast people sound when they're at normal speed. So I listen to, for example, I listen to the Missed Apex podcast, which is a great F1 podcast and you should go and subscribe. And I always have it on 1.5 times speed. And I did tune into a live stream a couple of weeks ago and was like, what on hell is going on here? The theme music is a dirge and they leave so many gaps. But why do they all talk so slowly? Are they all on drugs? No, it's just, this is what they sound like normally. And I'm used to hearing the like slightly sped up versions of podcasts. Interestingly, if I ever re-listen to an episode we do and I forget to turn the playback down to normal speed, then I hate it and I have to stop listening.
So what I would say is, if you do go back and watch it, I would certainly watch...
Tell me which ones to skip.
Well, I'll tell you which ones to watch. Let's be positive. So I genuinely would say that episode 1, which is the Aston Martin episode, is good. The episode 4, which is the battle between Haas and Williams, if only for James Vowell, who I think between... the high performance podcast that he was on, his remarks about the Christian Horner investigation and this, James Vowles is just, he seems to be the sort of person who would be the sort of leader where you would follow him, you know, into fire.
I'm a big fan of his even before he moved to Williams to be the team principal. I liked his time at Mercedes. I liked his honesty. And he has done nothing but go up in my estimation since going to Williams to be the team principal. He's got a job on his hands, but I admire his honesty. He has the same ability to speak clearly about the subject of Formula One that James Allison does with Mercedes, to explain concepts and to focus in on the root of the problem without getting drawn into discussions on things that truly don't matter. So episode 1, episode 4, how many episodes in the season?
There's 10. I would also say episode 9, which is the Daniel Ricciardo, Liam Lawson switch around. And episode 10, which is the Ferrari versus Mercedes battle for P2 in the championship, covers Las Vegas. And I think it's one of those where it really shows off... one, you get to see things like the aftermath of Carlos Sainz's drain cover incident in Las Vegas, but also... plays really nicely, it edits really nicely between Vasseur and Toto Wolff, and you see the differences between them. I think Fred Vasseur comes off as a really good, again, leader of men. And I think between those four, if you watch those four, the other ones, I mean, there's a whole episode which is, for some reason, Alpine have got one about Ocon versus... Gasly, and another one about, which is basically Otmar Szafnauer going stretched out to an hour. There is one episode which is Lewis Hamilton considering his Mercedes future, and the great reveal at the end of the episode is, I've considered all of my options and I'm staying at Mercedes for another 2 years. 4 days after Drive to Survive comes out.
Yeah.
So it's like, ugh. But genuinely, I think if you watch those four, if you think of this not as a race recap, not as like the end of season DVD, think of this as almost like the DVD extras of the 2023 season. I think this is what they're settling into now. I think it will, it really does add more than what we've seen probably over the last 2 to 3 years of Drive to Survive. So I would say
they've had to get creative because the racing has not been good for the last 2 years, bar a few outliers. So they've had to probably, and it's been running. This is sixth series, so it's been running a long time, and they've probably had some turnover in directors, some turnover in the way it's editing, feedback from the audience. So I'll go and give those episodes a shot. And report back on how I find them. Just as long as I don't have to watch Christian Horner riding a horse down the lanes around his country estate, being smug. I don't want to see that again. I'm not interested in seeing the Santa episode. You know, he got all the presents he wanted.
Two.
Right. Okay.
Speaking of things that have been running a long time, I'm king of the segues tonight, aren't I?
speaking of things, it's very good.
It's like
we don't write these, he just makes them up on the spot.
No one could write this. The Grand Tour has released their penultimate special, Sand Job, with a trip of Jeremy, James and Richard Hammond going across Mauritania. 5 points if you could have found that on a map before before watching the Grand Tour.
I still can't now. Me either. I'm really bad at geography.
It's the old John Oliver joke where it's just like, where he's got a map behind him and he says, you know, this is Mauritania, except it's not. This is Mauritania. That's not Mauritania either. You don't know what you're talking about. This is Mauritania. with a Jag V6, an Maserati Grand Cabrio, and a Aston Martin
DB9 Volante.
There we go. I have one thought with this. If whatever you think of Grand Tour, this is going to be it. If you hate it, you'll hate it. If you love it, you love it. The one thing that I noticed, and the one thing that I think, and I don't know if it's the fact they're getting towards the end, I don't know if they're just being a bit more indulgent, but it just felt baggy and a bit long.
Yeah, I don't disagree. There's a lot of... It feels like this is a... Not the final edit, not the first edit, but somewhere in between. Like, they got to a point and went, oh, that'll do.
Yeah.
Now, that is not fair. They never say that'll do, but this is not as tightly edited as some of the earlier specials or anything they did for Top Gear, or indeed the original sort of... tent-based Grand Tour. It is indulgent, and okay, they can indulge themselves. I don't really mind. There were bits where I was thinking, damn, they've spent a lot of time going on about this thing here, but
yes,
that's fine. I don't begrudge them that. If this is the last but one show and they feel like just having a bit of fun, that's okay. It passes the usual test of me going, I wonder how much Aston Martin DB9s are now. Which shows you which car I like the most, even though it was the least reliable by a long way, which is quite impressive when one of the cars in there is a Maserati. The car I liked the least was the most reliable one. It's Clarkson's white F-Type.
Really?
Yeah, I don't like F-Types at all. And I'm basing this entirely on one morning drive around Millbrook in one. On an SMMT day a very long time ago.
Wow.
And all the controls that were that nice burnished bronze colour, I thought would be beautifully anodized bits of metal, and they were all bits of cheap plastic. And that immediately put me off the entire car, to the point where I drove it around a bit, went, yeah, it makes a nice noise, but all the bits you touch are plastic. And I would quite happily have just burnt it at that point, because those are the important bits of the car. Because it's not a manual, Therefore, you don't have that sort of tactile gear change. Even if it's a slightly crappy box, you've still got that whole I am in control of the thing. When you're pushing a paddle and that paddle is rubbery and plastic but looks like metal, that's really disappointing. Really disappointing for a sports car. So I couldn't forgive it that. So when Clarkson shows up with one, I don't care how good it sounds or you've got a supercharger on with big tyres, I was all about that Aston, which I don't like the Volante at all. I'd have the coupe, but oh man, they still look good. And
yeah, they do.
People all over YouTube are buying them cheaply and discovering just how many things can go wrong with a mid-2000s V12 with a lot of Ford parts. I still want one. But yes, I thoroughly enjoyed the grand touriness of it, the three of them together bickering and so on, the bits that you knew were sort of staged, the bits that were very much not staged, the gags that didn't go on forever, the sort of, oh, we've hidden a speaker in your car. But that gag actually was quite short and sweet.
Also, my personal favourite was where they went to a town and they said, they did the, you know, and now we cue the music. And then they sort of did whatever it was, and they went, and after paying thousands of pounds for the rights to use the A-Team theme tune, it's just like, they're now just at meta level.
Yes, that was very I did enjoy that, though, because I was like, oh, they've got the real A-Team music in here for a change.
Yes.
And I had to, I think I was watching with my son, I had to explain the concept of the A-Team to him again, because he's very young compared to me. So, yes, I enjoyed it. If you like, this is exactly what you expect from the Grand Tour.
Yes.
If you are tired of their shtick, then you're not going to enjoy it. You just go watch something else. But if you are of a certain age and you like the classic Top Gear Grand Tour trio and their shenanigans, then this is more of what you love. So watch it, because this is the last but one. We got one more and then that is it.
It really is becoming Last of the Summer Wine comfort viewing.
It's totally comfort viewing. And, you know, Top Gear has been comfort viewing for me for decades now.
Well, yes.
When I'm, like, if I'm ill or I'm, you know, just not feeling it, there's nothing better than putting on something I've seen, you know, many, many times, like the Vietnam special or the Botswana special or one of the episodes that I've watched and have great fondness for, and just sort of letting it wash over you and go, I know what's going to happen, but I'm still going to laugh. When you know, Clarkson says, someone's drawn a penis on my helmet. And then the camera cuts to Hammond saying, I did that.
I did that.
Because that is exactly the kind of childish thing that makes me laugh. And that says a lot more about me than it does about Top Gear. Anyway.
I do wonder, before we move on, I do wonder, the last special that they do, which is Zimbabwe, are they going to just... Are they going to ride off into the sunset at the end of it? Is there going to be any sort of retrospective?
I wonder, because at the end of the tent-based show, Clarkson got a bit misty-eyed and emotional about the end of that sort of era of making television shows about cars. And I don't know if I want to see that again or if I want a, you know, thank you very much for watching, good night. And that's that. I don't know. What TV shows have stuck the landing when they've finished? Can you think of many?
I think the problem with this is that it's not like a narrative arc. It's not that thing of all the loose ends get tied up because there are no loose ends. It just... I think they've either got to it like The Sopranos and we just stop watching their life from now on as those characters... Or I was thinking maybe they could do like, what was it? I won't say The Breakfast Club. It wasn't The Breakfast Club. But where like the characters are all walking away and one by one they fade out and it's like so-and-so became a CEO. And
that feels... Oh no, there's a bit of... Animal House does that. But also I think Stand By Me has that sort of voiceover.
I think Stand By Me might be one I was thinking of where it's just like... You know, James went off and became a concert violinist and Richard Hammond, you know, discovered the cure for rabies or something.
I quite like that kind of silliness from them, acknowledging that these are characters you're seeing on screen that are exaggerated versions of themselves. Because we're going to see them on our screens separately Clarkson is still doing Clarkson's Farm. James May is doing his travelogues and shows no sign of slowing down with those. Hammond is going to have Hammond's Garage and other things. So it's not like this is them stopping broadcasting altogether. It's just stopping broadcasting a car show together. And in a brilliant segue to what we've been watching, listening to, what you should watch and listen to, James May appeared on the Intercoolers 200th episode. The Intercooler is a fantastic podcast with
Andrew Frankel and Dan Prosser.
I was trying to remember Dan's surname. I was just getting them the wrong way up. Where he talks very candidly about making the Grand Tour and how it's sort of people, the personalities on there are exaggerated, but they're not untrue. And that they do wind one another up, and it's kind of intentional, but there's a chemistry there and they all know it and acknowledge it. And that's part of how it's lasted for so long. It's a fantastic podcast because James is an exceptionally interesting person to listen to. He has really engaging ideas on the present and future of the motor car. He's lived it, he's done it, and he's just such a great guest to have on a podcast. I could have listened to 3 hours of it. It's an hour and a half, which is pretty long for their podcast. So far be it from us to suggest yet another podcast to go and listen to when you're not listening to this one. But that is available on the YouTubes as well as on podcasting platforms of your choice, and it's really worth a watch.
It really is. I mean, particularly as well, I realise this is very inside baseball for the car nerds. Welcome, our audience. But just hearing... There was something that I really liked. One thing that I did notice was that James is now just such a broadcaster. He's been doing it for so long. Like I say, he's really good. He's really clear. He can really articulate his ideas well. But I loved the thing that you don't normally hear, and particularly around Grand Tour time, you'll see interviews on radio and podcasts and stuff where they're talking about, oh, so, you know, what was it really like behind the scenes of the Grand Tour? What was it, you know, do you three really get along? You know, what's been your favourite car of all the specials? And then you get James May and Andrew Frankel going, which year was it that you came to Autocar? Oh, was it so-and-so? Oh, so which... Oh, yeah, oh, you hated us at that time of year, didn't you? Yes, well, you had to go off and do this. And it really had that sense of just two mates just sharing a world that I don't think was really covered.
Those are the best...
haven't talked about since.
Yeah, that's part of the joy of, for me, of the Intercooler, is that Andrew Frankel in particular has been working in the field for so long and knows so many people and has so many interesting stories and can get so many interesting guests onto their podcast or onto their platform, that you get an insight into things you wouldn't otherwise hear. You know, stories of road tests gone wrong, stories of... how it's like, what it's like to produce a magazine in the era of desktop publishing only just coming in, all this great stuff. And, you know, he's driven everything. He's done an awful lot of things. He's met an awful lot of people. And enough
time has passed that they can tell stories.
Yes. And so on that, you know, you've got Dan Prosser giving his sort of more recent opinion and side of things. And It's progressed really nicely. It did start out to me as a podcast where Dan asked Andrew questions and sort of and picked his brain, and they've progressed on really nicely. So yes, check that video out. Go subscribe to their podcast because it's excellent, and go and
the magazine.
Yeah, well, go website. pay for the website too. It's bugger all a month. It's price of 2 cups of coffee, and the writing on there is the best you're going to get. So
honestly, every morning at 7 a.m. on my iPad, there comes up a notification with some story, and almost every single day, it's a story that I never knew I wanted to read, and I immediately think, oh, that sounds interesting. Genuinely well worth ponying up. Give it a try.
Yeah. And not because we know people involved in it. We just like it. It's really, really good. What else have you watched? Oh, I know what you, I think it's... Who sent me this? Was it you that sent me this or somebody else? Red Bull's, like, 220-mile-an-hour drone.
Yes, that was
the world's fastest camera drone versus an F1 car. This is a really, really mega video of... I can't... like, they've got a drone that looks, and I can't think of a better way, it looks like a sex toy.
It looks like a big dildo, yes.
Yes, but it flies really, really fast. And there's a shot of it going around Silverstone, following Max Verstappen going around Silverstone. And Silverstone is a high downforce, really fast track. And the Red Bull is not short on any of those things. And it's remarkable watching like a whole lap being followed. And it's not swoopy drone. It's not that horrible.
No.
Swirly,
not the FPV sort of drone.
Not the, no, this, it actually tracks, it tracks straight and not straight and true, but you know what I mean. It's basically like the magic camera in a racing computer game where it's, yes, following you around the lap, basically hovering 6 feet above the rear wing. But this is a real life drone that can do this for real for 3 minutes at a time before it runs out of batteries and falls down on someone's head.
Well, so this is the thing. There's kind of two aspects to this. So the video itself isn't so much about Formula One. It's about getting a group of drone engineers. And this sounds really boring, but it's not, I promise. Getting a group of drone engineers together and say, can you make a drone that will keep up with the Formula One car over a lap? And it
could you also make it look like a penis?
But also,
four fans attached to the bottom.
But thing is, it also, it can't overheat, it's got to have enough battery, it's got to be manoeuvrable. And the thing is with this is, like, if you imagine, and there's no other way to describe this, if you imagine it, like, taking off, like, the propellers are like the balls. As it goes up, it basically has to do a 90-degree turn because it becomes a rocket.
You might, so what you might say is it becomes erect.
I think it,
it's just the most,
I think it starts off
floppy.
No, other way. It kind of starts off standing proud, and then at about 140 kilometres an hour, it kind of droops.
Anyway. Well, everyone wilts when their attention is somewhere else. I just wanted, the bit they cut out was the bit where they're like, so we're going to paint this pink, and the head is going to be purple on the top because it stands out on film. And some engineer go, wait, no, we can't do that.
No.
Just
But it's a really interesting video. One, because they just, they have to try and do it. And it's an interesting, oh, God.
This has gone back to Top Gear and Clarkson again. In the last episode, when they did Top Gear, the White Elephant episode, where they're off-roading and Clarkson has got a Volkswagen, Vauxhall Frontera, and he put some interesting wheels on it that had spokes in the shape of penises. And at some point during that video, he gets stuck in some mud and he just yells out of the car, "Come on, grippy penis wheels!" And now, all I can think of... all I can think of is some drone engineer. "Come on, speedy penis drone!" Which is now what? Without going through the whole video, please watch it because genuinely, this is an incredible achievement and it is spectacular. There is, I think it was on Autosport, I saw that they are talking to F1 about how to use the drone during a race weekend. They have safety concerns, and I understand that because if it runs out of battery, it's just going to fall down from the sky.
The bigger problem I think with it is that, if you're not careful, you have a 200-mile-an-hour missile that you suddenly lose contact with.
Well, quite. And there's also the small matter of medical helicopters, television helicopters, all also swooping around at something less than 200 miles an hour. But
there is a moment, actually, when they're doing this on this video, because it can track... I mean, it's worth saying, it's all manually controlled. There's none of this like auto-tracking stuff. And it's going down, I think it's going down the hangar straight, and there's the bridge. And for a moment, you just think, oh, that's going to hit the bridge. And then it just pulls up at the last moment and clears it. And you think, oh, my God. I could see this being like, you know when F1 are doing those graphics now with the safety car, where they're demonstrating track limits? So I don't think it'll be necessarily like... during qualifying, they send up a drone with each car for their hot lap or whatever.
Yeah.
But I could definitely see it being like, there will be some car that goes out, does a fast lap at the start of FP1, and that's their reference demo lap for the TV coverage.
Maybe that's quite a good way of doing it, to show the corners. I'd love for them to find a way to use it in quali. because the cars are at their lightest and they're fastest. And maybe they don't use it every circuit because maybe some circuits is just not compatible with, if you've got like tight nadri corners or there's a bunch of slow boring stuff. Like, it's not going to work in Monaco, right? But you can imagine somewhere like Monza, it's very scenic anyway, high speed, and you could have
Spa.
Spa. I mean, sure, it's going to be raining though. I don't know how it flies in the rain, you know, low cloud cover. But legit, apart from you joking aside that it looks like a giant knob flying around the place, it is such an achievement. And the lap, it's like watching a real life computer game footage, only every now and then you get that sort of imperfection that reminds you, no, this is real. And you can see a Formula One car working around a lap from a perspective that you don't get to see normally. I thought it was an incredible achievement. I wish it looked different. That's my only thing, is I feel it should look less
as a
knobby.
V1, I think they've done really, really well. And I think the only slight downer for me, well,
did it make you flop?
They do a test lap with Coulthard, I want to say, in the dry. And then when they do the lap with Verstappen, it's in the wet, so he's not going as fast. But you do get to see all the vortices coming
off the
car.
Aero working. I imagine there are some aero engineers at other teams who are watching that with great interest.
Because it was the RB20, wasn't it?
It was their shakedown test. So, yes, I imagine there's some interested faces looking around. You know, they won't have released anything they're not comfortable with, but even so, yes, that is very much worth a watch. We have not forgotten you, Henry. What has Henry Catchpole been doing since we last podded?
So, I saw this mentioned somewhere. And I want to say it was on the Top Gear YouTube channel that there is a new event organised by one of the Porsche family, which is, imagine the sort of Goodwood Festival of Speed in Aspen, Colorado on snow. And Henry is covering, I can't remember what it's called for the life of me, but it's basically, it's Henry driving these rather wonderful cars on a big snow circuit where Porsche have turned up with like their winning GT1 911 from Le Mans, which they basically jacked it up and put on snow tires and sent it out on the ice. And there's Ken Block's Huna Pegasus. And there's just all of these weird and wonderful cars in the middle of Aspen at this bizarre event, which I think is just going to become the biggest thing in the world.
I haven't seen this video. I haven't watched it yet. I've got a backlog of things to get through, and this is quite high on my list of things to watch. I can't remember who mentioned it. I definitely know somebody mentioned it. I can't remember where, but I'm going to check this one out. Henry's done another couple of things with Haggerty as well. Go to the Haggerty channel and look for Henry Catchpole. You'll see any number of great things from him. But yes, this one, because it's snow. I love the combination of cars and snow is always a winner for me. Some of my favourite episodes of Top Gear are the ones where they're doing stuff in snow. The winter special, the race between Harris and LeBlanc, where Harris is in a turbo cab and LeBlanc's in a Lamborghini Huracan Spider. They do all four seasons, but the last one is a race in the snow, which is very entertaining. Anytime there's snow involved, I'm always up for that because we don't get snow very much. And so I really enjoy that. So yes, check that one out. And finally, there's a video on Andy Wilman being interviewed by Ben Collins, the former Stig.
So this has been interview season. I don't know why, but it seems like every man and his dog is dropping interesting interviews at the moment. It's actually a two-part interview between Ben Collins, as you say, the second of the Stigs, and Andy Wilman, who, for those who recognise the name or don't know, He is basically like...
He is Mr. Wilman. When you're watching the Grand Tour and they get a text from Mr. Wilman, this is Mr. Wilman.
This is that Mr. Wilman. But who... And he and Clarkson were basically instrumental in bringing back Top Gear. He is basically like the fifth Beatle of the Grand Tour Top Gear era. And he's a man who is not afraid to say exactly what he thinks. There's stories, I mean, there's all sorts of stories in Richard Porter's book about him winding up car press offices and how he would turn up for important BBC meetings with all of his documents in a Sainsbury's carrier bag. But he doesn't give his interviews very often. But I think Ben and him have enough of a relationship that he really opens up. And he's charming and he's eloquent, but he's also one of those people who is clearly intensely clever, really knows what he wants, knows how to make something succeed, but doesn't shout about it. He doesn't kind of come in as like the big TV big shot who's got all the answers. He kind of sits with his shoes on Ben's couch, assuming that's which way around it is, saying like, oh yeah, we were just like mucking about. And you know, the Top Gear special was essentially created accidentally, and what it was like with the Stig, and what was, you know, what new Stigs have been like.
I'm really looking forward to think some of my favourite bits from Richard Porter's excellent book And On That Bombshell, which we've talked about ad nauseum on here. If you haven't bought it or read it or listened to it, please go and do it, because if you have any interest in Top Gear, it is one of the funniest and most insightful things you're going to read about that show. And his description of Andy Wilman as this kind of shambolic presence in the office who just generate mess and sort of accumulate detritus around his desk, is, it paints such a vivid picture of something. And then he'll just casually mention that, you know, he gave an incredibly generous wedding present, or that he paid the tab for somebody quietly without anyone noticing. It's I find him very interesting because, like you say, he's very insightful. He's behind the scenes, but he is absolutely essential to all of the Top Gear that we loved, all the Grand Tour that we've loved. And when you say goodbye to those three in the next special, whenever it comes out, we're also saying goodbye to Clarkson and Wilman and that kind of duo that have steered this slightly strange, slightly brilliant combo for the last 25 years. And what,
wow,
what Top Gear, which will come back in some form, what it needs is another Wilman. Like, where's that going to come from? Because they need another... they need another creative person and presenter. And I don't think they can be the same person. I think they need to be separate. I think that was how, you know, he and the five of them, if it's Porter, it's Wilman, it's Clarkson, Hammond and May.
Yeah.
You can't just do it with presenters, and I don't think you can do it with the writers' room either. So I haven't seen this yet. Again, like, backlog, been very busy. So I'm really, really looking forward to this, because this is as... I love director's commentary tracks. Like, you were talking about Drive to Survive being the director's commentary for the 2023 F1 season. I love DVD extras. I love commentary tracks. I love all that kind of nerdy deep dive thing, because we do this podcast. So I am absolutely on board for this. Ben Collins talking to Richard Porter a few episodes. Like, yes. That's a great talk. There's two of those episodes too. And that's a really interesting chat. Again, worth seeking out on Ben Collins' channel. But I think that brings us to the end of this show. That is all we have in our show notes. It's a nice rounding up. My timer says it's nearly an hour. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for keeping this show in your subscriptions. And if you haven't got it in your subscriptions, then you should go onto your podcast repository of choice and click that subscribe button, because it's very satisfying when we do drop an episode for you to go, oh, what are these morons going to talk about next?
Until next time, everyone.